Well, as technology keeps growing, you know, one of the things, we had our TV for years, and I always wanted to get a bigger one, and Debbie would never let us get a bigger TV until ours died. Well, I guess by God's grace, our TV died this past fall. And it was a beautiful day because we got to go get a new TV, and we got one of those smart TVs. How many people have a smart TV? I don't really know what's all up with smart TVs. I know it has all kinds of different apps on it that you can use and things like that that we never will use. But one thing we did discover with our smart TV is it has this thing called TV Plus. And TV Plus has all these other channels with just weird stuff on. Like one channel has all the show Wipeout from all around the world. But another show that we always watch as a family when we have some downtime is a channel called Fail Army. Have anybody ever seen Fail Army? What it is, 24 hours a day, round the clock, all it does is it shows videos, and these are people's home videos, of stuff happening to them, like they fail. Either they pull a prank that doesn't work, or they get in an accident. You know, something happens to them. And there's just something about watching somebody else take a header that's just oddly satisfying, isn't it? And I know for us, we kind of sit there and we watch it, and we just look and we go, oh, that'll leave a mark. Did you ever say that? You know, and it's funny because those marks that we have, I'm sure we all bear those kinds of marks from stuff like that happening to us. And those scars kind of live on long after the accident happens or whatever happens, doesn't it? The event. And when they do happen, it gives us something to talk about with others. We get to brag on. In fact, why don't you do this? Why don't you turn to somebody and ask them this question? You want to know about my scar? Okay. You don't have to tell them about it. Just ask the question. You can talk about it later. But yeah, people always do those kind of scar wars where they look at all different scars and they say, oh, this one happened. You know, I was attacked by a shark and, you know, all kinds of neat stuff, right? But it becomes kind of, you know, the effects of some of those fails and those bloopers and things like that become our legacy. And we get to kind of walk around and say, yeah, this is what I carry around with me. And when we talk about legacy, have you ever wanted to leave your mark or leave your legacy? How many people want to leave a legacy? Okay, 2.5 people want to leave a legacy. That's good. I had my rate, 3.5. Yeah, I mean, and what do we talk about with a legacy? Something that lives on beyond us, right? And for some of us, it's just as simple as when we were younger and we'd see that wet concrete and we'd want to, you know, put our name in that concrete so it would live on forever. And every time you pass that place, it's just always there. And that's our legacy, right? But for others, as we start to get old, maybe it's an achievement we have or a trait or a practice we do that lives on, maybe, and is passed on to our kids and maybe even their kids. The truth is, though, whether we mean to or not, consciously, we're all leaving a legacy. We're all leaving our mark on our kids, on our family, relationships, our workplace, and our world. In fact, as we return to Genesis this morning we're in Genesis chapter 49. We're almost done Genesis. But as we return to Genesis 49 this morning, we learn that through Jacob's last words, what we learn are some important truths about how we can leave our legacy. And as you turn, and you're going to need to have your Bibles open for Genesis 49, because we're going to be in there and digging in there this morning in Genesis. So if you have your Bibles, you can open that, or open your app, or the Bibles in front of you, you can open to that. And as you're turning there, I want to bring you up to speed. We've been going through the book of Genesis, and lately we've been looking at the life of Joseph. You know, God's faithfulness through him and this life on purpose. And we've kind of been going back and forth between Joseph now and Jacob as Jacob's older, because Jacob and Joseph are now reunited. If you remember, God used Joseph in an amazing way through his faithfulness to rescue the rest of his family, and also as a continuation of the promise that God had given to Abraham and to show his blessings through this family and continue showing it. So when the famine was in the promised land, or the land of Canaan where Jacob and all were, they had this famine and they came to Egypt for food, and Joseph was there and was able to rescue them, right? Now they're living in Egypt. And as they're living, they've been living in Egypt for about 17 years now. Jacob is very old. In fact, he's getting close to death. And as we saw in the last chapter, one of the things Jacob did was he brought Joseph in and he blessed Joseph. Even though Joseph's his 11th son, he's the first son of his most beloved wife, Rachel. So he adopts both of Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, as his own. And in essence, what he's doing is he's honoring Joseph, giving him a double portion, a blessing. So he just did that. And then he says, here's what I want to happen to me after I die. Now, what happens in the beginning of 49 is he gathers the rest of his sons together and he starts reflecting. He has final words for all of his sons. And he starts reflecting on his life, or it's this oracle of his life. And it's a mixture of blessings and indictments and promises and prophecy. But it all reveals what Jacob has learned from God throughout his life. And he's passing it on to his sons. So this is where we are in Genesis 49 as we go through this. And we'll stop along the way and explain what's going on. And we're going to go fast this morning, just so you know. If you've ever been through one of our Through the Bible classes and heard me talk, we're going to do that today. So we're going to go through cover almost 2,000 years of history in the next 8 hours. So we'll see how we do. We'll get through it all. But because he's telling the story of his sons and what will happen to them. So verse 1 says, Jacob called his sons, and he says, gather yourselves together that I might tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come, or after I'm gone. Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father. So this is kind of like if you go to the hospital and they're saying they don't have long and you all can't go in the room. So what he does is he's going to call his sons in one at a time to talk to them about their life and his life and what God had kind of revealed is going to happen. And he calls two of them in together, but the rest he calls in one at a time. And he's going to call them. Remember, he's got four wives, all these sons through four different women. So he's going to start with Leah's first wife and hit her sons and then kind of go through the line like that. So he begins with calling in Reuben, okay, which is his oldest son. Verse 3, he says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity, and preeminent in power. It sounds great, doesn't it? Yes. Verse 4, though, unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Okay, basically, Reuben's got issues. Now, on your note sheets, I have the 12 sons listed and kind of a gap. We're going to have kind of a word associate with that, and then we have what we fill in on the back of that. So it's two-sided this week. So as we talk about Reuben, but Jacob, he describes Reuben as unstable as water. Okay, so we can know Reuben as water, right? Water has no shape or structure to it, does it? It's got to be contained. It's uncontained unless you use something else to contain it. And this is how he's describing Reuben. He says, you're uncontained. Basically, you know, you just follow whatever passion and whim you have. You're totally undisciplined in your life. And as way of example, I'll share with you what I'm talking about, because you went up to your father's bed. Back in Genesis chapter 35, there's an incident with Reuben following his passions. And you know what he does? He sleeps with his stepmother. Bilhah. He sleeps with his stepmother. His dad's wife. He goes and has sex with him. Isn't this crazy? What? These are these children of promise? Yeah, this is Reuben. Okay? This is Genesis 35:22. You can just write that down and look at it later on about what's going to happen. So because Reuben, he just can't control himself, and he's not going to be honored as the firstborn. So he doesn't get the double portion because Jacob already gave that to Joseph. But he's also not going to get that the promised blessing or the inheritance blessing as the firstborn. So he tells him, Reuben, you're not getting this. Then he calls in the next two sons in line. He calls them in together because these guys come as a pair, Simeon and Levi. Okay? And they're also not going to be honored. Here's what he says to them. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. You know what he's saying? He said, I want nothing to do with you guys. For in their anger, they killed men, and in their willfulness, they hamstrung oxen, or they were cruel to animals. Cursed be their anger, for it's fierce, and their wrath, for it's cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So basically, what we find out about Simeon and Levi, especially back in Genesis 34 when we went through that, is these guys were like best buddies. And when they got together, mayhem ensued. they just found trouble wherever they went. And they were a mess. I had somebody tell me, yeah, if Simeon and Levi lived today, they'd be road rage guys. Okay? But here's Simeon and Levi. Mayhem follows them. And we saw how this happened with mayhem and violence always following him. Remember back in Genesis 34, they also had a sister. Her name was Dinah. And when they were up in the north part of God's promised land for them, there was this guy in the city, Shechem, and he falls in love with Dinah and he has sex with her. He rapes her. And then he comes back to the brothers and says, well, she's in my house now. You know, I kind of already defiled her, but I want to marry her. So the brothers get together and say, wait, this isn't good. And they said, all right, here's what you got to do. You got to get everybody, you and all the men in your city have to get circumcised. They got to become like us in this covenant and get circumcised. Then after they're healing up from being circumcised, Levi and Simeon go into the city and they murder every man in that city. And then they plunder everything in the city and take it for themselves. Crazy, isn't it? Then it talks about the hamstrung ox. This will be the equivalent of kids that go out and they put magnifying glasses on ants. You know, I mean, they're just cruel to animals. So this is Simeon and Levi, okay? So basically, he says, because of this, I don't want to be in your company, and your descendants are going to be scattered. In fact, what happens is these three brothers that we just talked about, all three of them get scattered. They're descendants. They all become tribes of Israel, but they become scattered. They don't get the blessings as some of the other tribes get. The tribe of Reuben, which was on the east side of the Jordan River, after they enter into the promised land, we don't hear anything about Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, anymore. They just kind of fade away. Simeon goes down into the Negev or into the desert, and we don't hear anything of them anymore. Actually, it becomes part of the tribe of Judah, that land. And then Levi doesn't get any land at all. In fact, they're made the priestly tribe, so they guard God's law. And they're scattered in the rest of the 12 tribes, and their survival is dependent on all the other tribes. So this is how they're scattered for no more, or for all times. Now, it's not all bad for Levi because they become vital in protecting God's law all the way up through the time of Christ. But they do it violently often and putting other people down and things like this. And it became very, you know, worse. But they became the people that protected God's law. In fact, in all that they did, this kind of uncontrolled anger followed them wherever they went. In fact, one notable man from the tribe of Levi was a man named Moses. Remember, he leads God's people out of Egypt and is getting ready to put them in the promised land. Except God says, no, you can't take them in there. Because you know what Moses did? The people complained to Moses that they were thirsty. And last time he did that, he was struck a rock and water came out. And God says, I don't want you to strike the rock. I want you to speak to it. But he got annoyed with the people. And in his anger, instead of speaking to the rock, he strikes it, disobeying God. And he just acted in anger. Water still came out, but God said, Moses, you can't enter the land. Because of your uncontrolled anger. Why? That was the legacy of Levi. Bearing fruit. Okay? Talking legacy, right? All right. So these three, because of their unrepentant sin, they leave a bad mark or a bad legacy. So now we turn to the fourth son in line, a guy named Judah. So he brings Judah in. And Judah starts out his journey, his story, just as bad as these other guys. But yet Judah would be called blessed. And I want to take you through this. So Judah is the fourth son in the line, and blessing's going to follow him, even though he got off to a really rough start. Here's what happens to Judah. Judah was the one brother. Remember when they were going to kill Joseph, and then they pulled him out of the pit? And Judah convinced his brothers, we can still get rid of him. Let's sell him, and at least we can make a profit off of this. That's not real good either. But God used that as a way of saving Joseph. But still, it wasn't good. Then Judah goes, and instead of marrying the woman that God wanted to marry, he goes to marry a Canaanite woman who worships idols and everything like that. And he ends up having three sons through her, and then she dies, but his sons are evil. His oldest son marries a woman named Tamar. And this son's so evil that God takes him. God kills him. Well, now Tamar, she doesn't have any kids and doesn't have any legacy to leave. So he takes the second son in line and has her marry Tamar. Has him marry Tamar and says, you got to have kids. He says, I'm not doing it. He doesn't want to have kids through her. So he doesn't have kids through her. And that doesn't work out. So then he goes to the third son. The son says, I'm not even marrying her. So now he doesn't know what to do. And poor Tamar's left there without an heir. and she's in disgrace, right? So what Tamar does one day is she poses as a prostitute. And she presents herself to all these guys where Judah's with them, and Judah sees her, and he hires her and has sex with her. And she gets pregnant. So in essence, Judah fathers his grandchildren. You can't make this up, can you? It's crazy. And you're like, well, how is Judah any better? Because sometime after this, Judah turns around. He turns it around. God grabs him, and he starts to say, I'm going to be faithful to my father and to my father's gods. Because then we start seeing things happen with Judah that are in a positive light. When the brothers get sent to Egypt, and they meet this ruler who they don't know is their brother Joseph, but they meet him trying to get food, and he says, you need to bring your youngest brother back. So they go back and tell Jacob. Jacob says, oh, no, nobody's bringing Benjamin back, because if he goes, I'm going to die. Judah's the one who steps up and says, no, I'll put myself up and my family as collateral. If anything happens to Benjamin, I'll vouch for it. So then he allows Benjamin to go with the brothers. Then he goes with the brothers, and Joseph has a servant put his cup in Benjamin's bag, and they find it, and they say, oh, Benjamin, now you have to stay here as a slave forever. Judah is the only brother who steps in and goes, nope, nope, nope. This guy can't stay. I'll stay as your servant for the rest of my life. And I'll put myself up. So he puts himself in his brother's place to save his brother. And then through all of this, Jacob starts to look at Judah as the most trusted son. So when Jacob's brought to Egypt and they're going to settle in the land of Goshen, it's Judah that he sends ahead and says, you go set everything up for the family. I'm going to trust you to set everything up so the family can come. So Judah then becomes this trusted son. So much so that Jacob pronounces this in verse 8. He says, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub, and from my prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouches a lion, and as a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff between his feet, until this tribute, or some of your Bibles may say Shiloh, comes to him. And he shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine and the donkey's colt and the choice vine, and he washes his garments with wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. What does all this have to do with anything? What does it mean? Here's what he's saying. Judah, I'm comparing you to a lion. The lion is the king of the animals. So he says, you're going to be the king. Your legacy that you are leaving is going to be a royal legacy, and you're going to rule over all of your brothers and all of our descendants. You're going to rule over them. And sure enough, Judah, the tribe of Judah, was where the kings came from and ruled over Egypt until this tribute, or Shiloh, has come. You know what the Shiloh literally means? Peace. Until peace has come, you shall rule over Israel. And you know what this peace refers to? Remember at Christmas time, we read through some of the prophecies about Jesus in Isaiah. Isaiah 9:6 talks about Jesus and said, his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of peace, or Shiloh. So right here, Jacob's saying, and through you will come the Messiah. The ultimate of blessings will come through you. So God's promise would come through Judah then. This promise that was given to Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob, it's going to continue through Judah. And Judah, through Judah would come prosperity, would come land, would come blessing, and ultimately this promised Messiah, the Savior. Pretty awesome, isn't it? And then he calls in the next six brothers, one at a time, and we just have little short snippets of these brothers. These brothers are two more sons of Leah, two of Bilhah, and two of Zilpah. And the reason why he kind of calls them in, they're real short, is because these guys are unremarkable. Their legacy is just meh. It's some good. They're not really doing anything special. It's kind of mediocrity and little impact. But I still want to touch on them because we're talking about legacy. So the first in verse 13 is Zebulun. Zebulun, you shall dwell at the shore of the sea. You'll become a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Now the tribe of Zebulun, his descendants, they don't really settle on the sea. They settle a little inland, but on a river. And they provide all the wood for seafaring people, for primarily the Phoenicians, to build all their boats. So they become this haven for ships. And while that's kind of cool, they really don't do anything else besides that that's noteworthy. And then there's Issachar. He says, Issachar, you're a strong donkey crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant of forced labor. He's basically saying, Issachar, you're a strong donkey. What's a donkey? A donkey's a workhorse. So you're a strong worker. You can get stuff accomplished. But you know what? You're lazy. And this is the legacy you're going to leave, that you have all this potential, but you're lazy. Right? It says that and where the tribe of Issachar settled, okay, beautiful area, and a lot of potential there. And it says, but you saw a resting place was good, and the land was pleasant, so you bowed your shoulder to bear, became the servant of forced labor. They went in there. They didn't drive the Canaanites out. And they just said, we're just going to settle here. We don't really want to accomplish anything. So what happens is the people that wanted to get stuff accomplished, they used people from Issachar to do their work. It's kind of like when you're always paying off debt. And all your money's going into paying off debt. And you never get ahead. This is Issachar. Okay? So you're a strong donkey, but you're lazy. Then he says in verse 16, he addresses Dan. Dan, you're the judge of his people, as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan is the smallest tribe of Israel on the southwest coast, right by where the Philistines were. And he says, Dan, you'll be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so the rider falls backward. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. So Dan's the smallest one, and they're a snake. They're clever. They get things done by hook or by crook. In fact, it talks about a judge. You know, the most famous judge from the tribe of Dan was a guy named Samson. You remember Samson? And he had all this ability, but most of all, he was shrewd. And he would trick people all the time because he was a snake. And he was always trying to get what he wanted, but then he would kind of use a guise of, well, I'm going to do this. And he would go after the Philistines. After he's gone, the tribe of Dan, they say, we can't defeat the Philistines. So instead of just saying, well, we're going to trust God to do this, they look north and they see this land of Laish. And they say, well, that's unprotected. Let's just go take that. And they take that and they settle there. But again, they allow everything else to come in on them because they just want what they want. And they end up building idols to other gods and things. So they did some good. But again, they had potential, but they were too smart for their own good. And that's what he's saying about Dan. Then he addresses Gad, and Gad's pretty cool. Raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. So he basically says, you know what, Gad? You're going to raid raiders. And Gad was another one of these tribes that settled on the east side of the Jordan River. Being on the east side of the Jordan River, they're kind of like on the outpost, the outskirts. So every nation that wanted to attack Israel would start with Gad. So Gad became fierce warriors. And they were great soldiers, and they knew how to protect themselves. The problem was, since they were on the outskirts, they were always getting attacked. They could accomplish nothing else because they're spending all their time defending themselves. But they become great soldiers. In fact, it's men from Gad who come to David's aid when he's being pursued by King Saul, who wants to kill him. It's men from Gad that come up to help David and become part of his army. But so that's Gad. Next, verse 20, another brother named Asher. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield your royal delicacies. Okay, I always think of this with Asher, with the chocolate-covered pretzels I get every Christmas. Royal delicacies. This is Asher. Basically, but here's what happens to Asher and what he is. He's a pleaser, or he has a lot of potential, but he doesn't want any conflict. He doesn't want to ruffle any feathers. In fact, the tribe of Asher, where they settle, is a beautiful area where it's very fertile up on the northwest coast, and they become great farmers, but they go in, they don't drive out the Canaanites. They're like, we can live amongst them. So they live amongst them. So they really don't follow God wholeheartedly. Yet they become very rich because they're very good farmers and they're very good land and they're very good with their hands and things like that. But yet they're not wholly committed to God. Again, being rich isn't everything. Then Naphtali. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. You know what he's saying to Naphtali? You're so pretty, and you're going to have such pretty kids. You're always going to look good. So Naphtali, he was probably the best looking of all the brothers. And he says, you're a doe, and you're going to bear beautiful fawns. Now Naphtali, the tribe of Naphtali, where they settled, is New Testament area, is where the Sea of Galilee is, the region of Galilee. Okay? And what becomes of Galilee? Again, Naphtali, you're going to look great, but really you have nothing. you're not going to be considered great. You're just going to look great. And in New Testament times, the times of Jesus, right, Galilee was considered this beautiful area, but nothing great comes from the Galilee area. You see how that comes true? But, you know, you're going to always care about outward stuff and have nothing inside, then that's all you got. Then he calls back Joseph. Now it starts getting good again. Because he calls back Joseph, and he has a lot more to say to Joseph. And it's all about blessing. And he says, Joseph, you're a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough is by a spring. His branches run over a wall. So everywhere you go, you're going to bless others. You're going to be a blessing to others. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings from heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills, maybe on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. So Joseph's going to be set apart, and he says, you know what? You're going to be a blessing to others. And even though everybody's tried to put you down, your brothers sold you into slavery, Potiphar accused you, threw you in jail, and you were always gone, you know, that you were forgotten there. But yet, you know what? You stayed faithful through it all because you're a rock. This is your legacy, Joseph, that you'll be faithful to God, and your descendants will be faithful to God. And because of that, they'll be great. They'll be great in number. And in fact, they'll go up to the everlasting hills. Now, his son Manasseh, who became adopted son of Jacob, the tribe of Manasseh is the largest tribe of all of Israel. They take up land on the east side of the Jordan and the west side all the way to the sea. The largest tribe. Talk about blessing. Then from that tribe came probably the most famous judge, Gideon, who's known for his faithfulness in God. Then you have his other son, Ephraim. Right? We talked a little bit about Ephraim and what becomes of Ephraim, because Ephraim, where they settled, was in the hill country, the fortified hill country, and that's what they took. You know, the most defensive area, secure area, and that's these everlasting hills it talks about at Ephraim. But they were noted for their faithfulness in God. In fact, from the tribe of Ephraim comes a guy named Joshua who was sent to spy out the promised land with 11 other guys, and he and Caleb, who was from the tribe of Judah, were the only two that said, you know what, it looks impossible, but with God, it's possible, and he'll do it. And they stayed faithful in God. And it was Joshua then who led the people in to settle the land. An Ephraimite. Another Ephraimite was a guy named Samuel, who was the last judge, first real prophet, the guy who bridged the gap from the judges to the kings, which lead to Jesus. That is Samuel. So that's Ephraim. So your legacy will be that of blessing. Then he gets to Benjamin. You're like, wow, if he did that with Joseph, man, he's going to really talk a lot about Benjamin. Look how much he talks about Benjamin. One verse. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf in the morning, devouring the prey, and at evening, dividing the spoil. Here's Benjamin's legacy through his tribe and through his descendants. You will be ravenous wolves. Or you will be superheroes. You are going to be such mighty warriors that, man, nobody can come against you. In fact, over and over again, during the time of the judges, when civil war breaks out, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, defends themselves against 10-1 odds and is victorious. And then you know what else happens to Benjamin? After Solomon and the kingdom splits, after King Solomon, and Israel went, and all the tribes go with Israel except for Judah, right? So then you have Judah and Israel. Well, one other tribe stood with Judah and said, no, we'll stand with you. And that was Benjamin. And after that split, the only nation that had any good kings was from Judah, which was made up of Judah and Benjamin. So that's what you have here with these sons. Now, who came from Benjamin? Well, King Saul came from Benjamin, who was the first king, and he was a mighty warrior. There was another guy named Saul who came from the tribe of Benjamin. This guy, Saul of Tarshish, you might have heard of him, became known as Paul. You know what he was? He was a mighty warrior defending Judaism when Christianity started to rise, and he would defend Judaism. Then after his conversion, you know what he became? A warrior for Christ through the legacy of Benjamin. So this is what He shares. And in verse 28, kind of closes it up. Here's what Jacob says. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to them or the legacy that they would leave. And these legacies that he's talking about, it mirrors the life of Jacob, because it's Jacob's legacy as these sons, right? It's marked by some pretty unfaithful times of Jacob, if we remember some of those unfaithful times early in his life. Yet, he's always growing. And he becomes marked by the work and the promise of God. In fact, through the legacy of Jacob, you know what we discover? We discover some important truths that, when we can grasp them, help us leave this kind of lasting good legacy to our children, to everyone we come in contact with in our world, and beyond. We can leave this kind of legacy. So, as we quickly wrap up, I want to kind of wrap this together, and I want to give you, I just want to highlight what we learned from Jacob's legacy here that helps us leave a mark. And there's three truths I want to share with you. And the first one is, we learn through the sons of Jacob, is that our influence outlives us. You want to leave a legacy? Know this: your influence outlives you. It outlives me. Now, when it's a negative influence, it's pretty bad. And we see that through Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, right? It haunts them and weakens their descendants for generations upon generations, as negative behaviors are repeated and they intensify. It can go like this with our lives as well, can it? When one generation's caught in sin or failures, we get tied up, they get passed on to the generation. You ever heard generational sins? You know, things like alcoholism, and then your kids are that much more likely to become alcoholics. And where's that cycle break? You know, and violence and all of these things. You know why? Because our influence outlives us. And they intensify and they get passed on unless the curse somehow is broken. That's why we can never take sin lightly and say, it'll be fine. That's what grace is for. You know, we can never just say, I'm not going to deal with it. It'll fix itself. No, it won't. No, it won't. It needs to be broken. But however, in the same way negative can live on, positive can live on. We see this through Joseph and through Judah, right? Their descendants, they become more secure in their faith through generation to generation, through the faith of their fathers. And that's why Paul talks about that when he's talking to his protege or his son in the faith, Timothy. And he says, and what you've heard from me and in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. See, we can carry that on as well, because our influence outlives us. And we can have that positive influence. However, the reality is this. You know what? This side of heaven, we will never be perfect. We'll still experience failures and struggles. We'll have times where we just blow it. But we can take heart in this, as we see through Jacob's legacy, is that no failure is final. We are never too far gone where God can't restore. Do you know that with your legacy, with my legacy? And this is best seen through Judah. Judah's going down that same path as his older brothers are going down. And it looks like, man, how can anything good come from there? But God's still with him. He's desiring to restore him, restore his life, and most importantly, restore his legacy. Do you know why? Because this is our God. This is what our God desires to do, that he loves us despite our sin. When we're at our worst, he loves us. And he restores us when we run to him. He says, I want to restore you. In fact, Jesus himself said this when he's talking to the crowds in Matthew. He says, come to me, all you labor and are heavy laden. I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and I'm lowly in heart. You'll find rest for your souls, for my yoke's easy, my burden's light. So if you feel like you're carrying too much and you can't go on, and you say, I've messed up too bad, and you're here this morning and you said, man, I've blown it, you know, I failed my spouse or I failed my kids. I've gone too far to make it right. Know this. God can make it right. God can heal. God can restore what's been broken. God can make us and those we've affected through our failures whole again. God can restore that because no failure is final with God. In fact, in restoring Judah, God shows the ultimate picture of his love and grace in this restoration by having Jesus come through his line. Come as one of his descendants, the promise of salvation, wholeness for not only Judah, but the entire world is part of Judah's, this once broken man, his story, his legacy. And it's through this promised Messiah that now for us has come. This Jesus who lived the life we could never live. He lived the perfect life that we can't live, the life God requires. He died on the cross to take our sin, the penalty that we could never pay. He rose from the dead, defeating death, defeating that curse for all time, that he gives now life to us as a gift. That's this Jesus, this picture we have. And he did this for us to free us from failures and sins of our pain of our past. Because as we learn through Jacob's legacy, Jesus changes everything. In fact, this is what we learn. We learn that our influence outlives us. No failure is final because Jesus changes everything. Do you see the message of the gospel in this oracle of Jacob? Is the message of life in the gospel. The curse of sin that destroys lives and generation that separates us from God is broken by Jesus. Despite our sin, Jesus came to us. Again, he lived for us, he died for us to make us whole again. In fact, Paul summarizes this so beautifully in 2 Corinthians, where he says, therefore, if anyone's in Christ, he's a brand new creation. The old's passed away, behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us or made us whole again with himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. He gave us a legacy. Not only did he restore us, but he gives us a new legacy to leave. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting the trespasses against them, and entrusting to us this same message. Therefore, we're ambassadors of Christ. God making his appeal through us, we implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God, who for our sake made him to be sin, who knew no sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God. We're brand new in Jesus. It's the culmination of this promise that was given to Abraham and then carried through his sons, passed on through Jacob and then his sons, especially Judah. And ultimately, it's for us. Jesus restores the relationship we broke. Not only makes us new and clean, but makes us part of his legacy. That legacy to restore others to Jesus because we're his ambassadors. Now we become part of his legacy. You see, only Jesus can change your heart. Our relationship with him, our destiny and legacy, our influence in our world, only Jesus can give us that. Because he changes everything. So, you know, as we kind of wrap up and we look at our legacy, our mark, you know, leaving our mark on our world, it doesn't begin with that. It doesn't begin with the mark we leave. It begins with the one who marks us. Only then can we begin leaving a mark that matters or a legacy that matters. So we don't mark anyone. We take the mark of Jesus. In Jesus, we not only have life now and forever, but also influence that outlives us. That's a beautiful legacy. And you know what? If you don't know Jesus, you haven't given your life to him, you can talk to me afterwards about this because, you know, it's a free gift for us. He's done for us what we could never do for ourselves. There's no hoops to jump through. We need to trust him. We need to place our lives in his hands, our legacy in him, so he makes us brand new. But as we walk in this, know this, Jesus changes everything. Our legacy is tied to him. Let's pray.